On the Record with Gavin Riley on News Talk.
Busy show on the way over the next 2 hours, but we will start, as always, by taking a look across the Sunday papers. And we'll start with the front page of the Sunday Independent. Big splash of the story. It didn't quite make it into the papers, but is on the online version of some of the others today. Comments from Micheál Martin in New York last night. Taoiseach indicates jabs on the way for over fives. Rollout will require clinical okay. And this is the story from Hugh O'Connell and Maeve Sheehan, who, of course, was in New York. That Micheál Martin has signalled the state is going to move to vaccinate children between the age of 5 and 11 against COVID, if advised to do so. Obviously, it has to go through the EMA, it has to go through NIAC, etc. After Pfizer has come out and said that they have a jab, they've done clinical trials on it and they say it's safe and highly effective. Taoiseach Micheál Martin saying he's no issue with the principle of vaccinating children as young as five, but said they would be bound by public health advice and all the different rigours that has to go through. We will have Minister for Children, Roger O'Gorman, on the show after 12, and we'll be asking him about that, what he thinks, when it's likely to happen, and all that. Another story on the front page of the Sunday Independent. Irish air traffic control close to shutdown. And this is Fergal O'Connor writing that air traffic control closures and disruptions to Dublin bound flights were narrowly avoided yesterday after a serious trade union source has claimed, and some serious issues going on there. Moving to the front page now of the Sunday Times. A few COVID stories in the front page. HSE seeks 6,000 new staff to beat backlogs, writes Stephen O'Brien, the political editor of the paper. He's saying that the HSE plans to hire more than 6,000 permanent new staff in the final quarter of this year to tackle growing hospital waiting lists and restore full non-COVID services. That's according to Paul Reid, obviously the head of the HSE. And a lot of that, you see this across the Sunday papers if you pick any of them up today, there's a lot of pre-budget speculation and shifting and sanding from all the different groups who, and very deserving groups, it has to be said, in a lot of cases, who are looking for money ahead of the budget. The HSE obviously chief among them. Hospital reveals 49 nurses have refused the vaccine. This is another story on the front page at the Times from Mark Tye. Beaumont Hospital in North Dublin, which took legal action over false claims that it was forcing staff to get COVID jabs, has revealed that 186 workers have refused, or declined rather, I should say, instead of refused, to be vaccinated. 8 medical staff, 49 nursing staff and 57 administrators on that list. Below the fold in the Times, state bungled Armagh event, says ex-minister. This is Charlie Flanagan, the former Justice Minister and Minister for Foreign Affairs, criticised the state's handling of that invitation to President Michael D. Higgins from church leaders about the ceremony marking the partition and the foundation of Northern Ireland. Moving to the front page of the Business Post, a few interesting business stories that we're going to get on to with my newspaper panel very shortly, but they've gone on the front page of the story from Peter O'Dwyer and Lorcan Allen. Government preparing to concede on corporation tax rate of 15%. And this has kind of been building for the last few weeks. Obviously, this OECD group of more than 130 countries, they've agreed to a global minimum rate of tax. We haven't signed up for it, but for the first time, ministers and indeed the Taoiseach are conceding or suggesting that we will be moving in that direction, and that previously immutable 12.5% rate is likely to come up. Irish government likely to sign up for the OECD deal is what the Business Post is reporting. On the other side of it, news on Intel. Obviously, they've been in the news because of data centres, another thing we're going to get into in the context of climate change later in the show. Intel sought IBEC briefing on planning and delay challenges. They have obviously also questioned, I suppose, their future investment in Ireland if data centres continue to get the go-ahead and the amount of energy they are pulling off the grid. Below the fold, interesting story from Michael Brennan here in the Business Post. Owners of vacant properties to lose exemption from rates. The owners of vacant offices, pubs and shops are facing the prospect of higher bills on their properties next year to encourage them to sell off for housing. Again, a bit of pre-budget speculation, if you like, from the housing minister. I think the most interesting story, though, that I've seen in the papers, it does come on page 3 of the Business Post. Electricity system is stretched beyond capacity, Airgrid to warn. This is Daniel Murray writing that an Airgrid report due out this week is going to show that it won't be possible to secure enough new electricity generation in the years ahead to meet the rapid increase in power demand, which obviously is worrying for all of us. Bills have been going up, potential blackouts over the winter, even though Eamon Ryan has denied that. We'll try and get into that with Roger O'Gorman as well later in the show. Finally, to the Mail on Sunday. Warnings over 700 million COVID-19 welfare hangover is the front page story from John Drennan and Nicola Byrne. Essentially, they are writing that The coalition is bracing itself for lengthening dole queues as new figures reveal the number of unemployed will soar by at least a third when the COVID supports end. So another tricky issue for the government to deal with in the budget. When do you fully taper out all the different COVID supports? The PUP, of course, due to come down to job seekers levels around February, and that's when we could see potentially another boost or another increase in the people who are unemployed or who are on the dole, according to the Mail on Sunday. So there's plenty in there, plenty more in the papers, of course, and we're going to get into that now because I am joined in studio by my two panellists, Aoife Moore, political correspondent with the Irish Examiner, and John O'Brien, professor of European politics at NUI Maynooth. Guys, very good to have you in studio.
Thank you for having
Thanks,
me.
Thanks, John.
John, we might start with you because, of course, it's an election day. That sniff of an election is in the air, just not here in Germany. So you might bring us up to speed for those who maybe haven't been following it. This is one where we think the result is probably going to look quite like our own election last year.
Yes, Sean. Germany's political system is, like ours and many, many others in Europe, very fragmented nowadays. So we have three big parties and then a range of smaller parties. The CDU, Angela Merkel's party, has been the largest party, the most important political party in Germany since the foundation of the state in 1949. But it's been displaced in the course of the election campaign by its centre-left rival, the SPD, which has been ahead in the polls for most of the campaign, although the gap has narrowed very significantly over the last week or so. And the third party is the Green Party, which earlier in the spring looked like it was making extraordinary advances. It showed up at 26% in one poll ahead of the SPD and the CDU, but it's sort of gone back to about 16-17%. So those are the really big players. But behind them, we also have to consider the small liberal party, the FDP, which has traditionally since 1945 and 49 been part of some coalitions with the CDU mainly. And in addition to that, we have the far left party, Der Linke, which may or may not get seats in the Bundestag. It's hovering around the threshold of 5%. I think it probably will get in, but it's not absolutely certain. And the final party then is the far-right party, the AfD, the Alternative for Deutschland, polling about 10%. It's not going to be part of any coalition, but it does extremely well in eastern Germany and probably will come out as the largest party in Lower Saxony, for example. So it looks like Germany is set for a lengthy period of coalition formation, as happened in Ireland last year, in the Netherlands and elsewhere. The most likely new formation, I think, is going to be the SPD and the Greens, which were last in office together from 1998 to 2005. And some speculation that there is inevitably going to be a third coalition party, which would be the first time that happens in Germany since the foundation of the state in the new Germany in 1949. So the speculation sort of goes from the AfD with the SPD and the Greens to possibly a SPD Green Der Linke coalition. I think that's much less likely, in fact, but I wouldn't rule out the CDU. In fact, if you look at the narrowing of the polls in the last week, the CDU has actually made up a lot of ground again, and I wouldn't be surprised this evening if we saw the CDU actually emerge on top and edge out the SPD. That doesn't mean that they're going to come back into power. There'll be a lot of very difficult negotiations ahead, but it's a fascinating election and, needless to say, hugely important for Europe as much as Germany.
Of course, because they're massive influence. So you're kind of thinking something of a left-leaning government in Germany for the first time in quite a while. You mentioned the CDU coming back. How much of that is the outgoing influence of Merkel? Because she said she wasn't going to be really involved in this campaign, and then when the polls looked likely, she kind of jumped back in and sort of had Schultz on her arm, you know, like, oh, no, this guy's great, trust me.
Yeah. Well, I think one of the key features of the German system is the constant search for stability. There's a really kind of overarching conservative set of impulses. So even the SPD, you know, is being led by Olaf Scholz, the finance minister in the current coalition. I mean, he's been describing himself openly as the Merkel continuity candidate in the campaign. But I think my reason for thinking the CDU may yet emerge ahead is that the evidence over a long period of time is that Germans do tend to gravitate towards more conservative options. as we get to federal elections, and that might well happen again today.
If it's something of a thankless task to replace Angela Merkel, whoever it ends up being, either within the CDU, but also whoever ends up being the Chancellor.
Yeah, I was actually thinking about this morning. It's totally the end of an era. She's been the Chancellor for 16 years. Like, that's half my life. And yeah, the more you read about her, you know, she's trained as a scientist and was always seen as very facts-driven, a very pragmatic kind of person. And that's obviously stood in her stead. Like, the German people obviously really reacted well to that and stuff. But yeah, I think like it's huge shoes to fill for anyone who takes it. But though the criticism I was actually reading this morning about Merkel was that she's so pragmatic, so it was like very small progress, but lots of, you know, agreement on that progress. So things like climate change, stuff that need really radical changes, Merkel was not going to be the person who was going to bring that in. I was reading that she's kind of pushed her own party, who were seen as, you know, a lot more centre-right. She's pushed them a lot more to the centre, to be a lot more liberal. Obviously, they had the gay marriage, or equal marriage referendum, things like that. So I think she seems to be this kind of everything in baby steps, and we'll get there eventually. But as we know, with all the crises that are coming down the line, I think when it comes to things like climate change, they were saying that this has been a big thing in the German election, that they're very interested in, you know, the climate. They had those awful floods there a few months ago. It's very like top of mind. And I think some people are going to be looking for something a lot more radical than Angela Merkel's kind of agreement-driven kind of progressive policies and baby steps. I don't think that's going to be enough for people anymore.
It's an interesting one, and John kind of touched on it earlier, because we're looking at whoever it is, not just on the German stage. That's a totally separate thing that they're electing on, but we're looking at the European stage and where she has been this figure. And I remember
she's
from covering
like the leader of Europe
for so long. And
yeah,
the gravitas. I remember when we were over covering the Brexit negotiations over in Brussels, and it's such a strange little thing they have there in the EU Commission buildings, where you literally could be walking down a corridor and suddenly a world leader passes you by, but they don't all pass you by equally. You know, there was kind of, there's the Merkel and Macron and some of the other ones, and Theresa May and then Boris Johnson, who just have this gravitas that they bring, and that's probably going to be missing from the stage for a while.
Yeah, and I think the thing with Merkel, why people really related to her, is we've had so many like bombastic, ridiculous men, you know, from like Donald Trump to Boris Johnson, and like there's that really famous picture of her rolling her eyes at Putin, I think it is. That kind of calm, kind of serene, facts-driven woman, people really relate to, especially when they're stood next to an absolute foe like Boris Boris Johnson. So I think that's something people really miss. I think the thought of, you know, Angela Merkel no longer running Germany, no longer being on the European stage and being replaced by a man in general, kind of makes me a bit sad. I think, you know, women do bring a certain type of pragmatism, and I think without Merkel and people like her and von der Leyen during the Brexit process, I don't know where we would have been without her. And they did, you know, stand very tall when it came, you know, to squaring up to someone like Boris Johnson. And I think she will be most definitely in Europe.
John?
Yeah, I think the jury is out on Merkel's achievements, to be honest. On the plus side, very understated politician, very humble, lives in a very kind of nondescript apartment in central Berlin, does her own shopping in the supermarkets. People admire her because she has a kind of ethical core about her. But on the other side of the balance sheet, there are really important things. Eva mentioned the lack of action on climate change in Germany. A lot of fears that Germany's infrastructure has really not been future-proofed, and the CDU has been sort of neglectful in that sense. You mentioned the floods, and the two things are sort of linked there, I think, together. So I think any new left government, if it comes in, would be kind of confronted with those kind of issues. But there are other things too at European level. For example, she's taken a very softly approach with Russia. Part of that, again, is about energy. The Nord Stream 2 pipeline, which is just about to be completed, it's been very controversial because it really leaves Germany, and you could argue Europe, much more vulnerable to Russian pressure, to leverage that Putin can use in his various disputes. There are other areas too, where on sanctions and other things, she really hasn't followed through enough on Russia. I would say the same thing about Europe's authoritarians. For example, for a long time, the CDU was the most important protector of Viktor Orban's Fidesz party, a sister party within the European People's Party. And even last summer, when the Germans had the presidency of the EU, what they did was to try and water down the new rule of law proposals, which came out of some member states and the European Parliament, which again gave Orban a break. You could say the same thing about Bulgaria. Again, she has kind of protected Boyko Borisov, who's commonly seen as an almost mafia-type politician in Bulgaria. Again, part of the European People's Party. And again, if you look at the Eurozone, our memories are in some ways quite short because the treatment of Germany, of Ireland, where Merkel said at that time, the only way out of this crisis is by imposing austerity. Mm-hmm. And that hit the poorest people in many, many vulnerable communities right throughout Europe. Mm-hmm. So when I say that the jury's out, I mean, I take a more negative approach than many people might. There are lots of really problematic things, I think, associated with Merkel's tenure, even if I think you're both right saying she's absolutely the most important European figure of the last 20 years. But finally, just to say that every time there's a change of leadership in Germany, because it's so big and important and powerful, people worry. But if you, again, go back to 1949, there's been great continuity, irrespective of whether Germany is led by the CDU or the SPD. There's been much more continuity than change when a new government comes in.
Mm. Watch it, because Enda Kenny during the week was, you know, sort of suggesting, well, Merkel ultimately was a friend to Ireland in the long run. Like, do you buy into that, or do you think there was a lot that she did to this country by her influence in the EU that actually is quite comprehensible?
Yeah, I think you've got to think about this carefully. There are all those negative things associated with the bailout. I mean, Greece was at the point where it was going to hold a referendum on the proposed EU bailout, which was really a bailout of the banks that had lent money to Greece. And Merkel's chancellery came along and said, no, you can't do it. And that was really overt interference in the politics of another member state. But of course, Enda Kenny is absolutely right that more recently, you know, when he explained to her the importance of the border, he didn't really need to because she instinctively understood it, having been born in the GDR with that border really defining the early years of her life. And she, I think, was very, very important to Ireland. Remember all those bombastic Brexiteers saying, well, the EU can't afford to do without us. German car makers, what will they possibly do without being able to sell into our markets? Well, the answer is very clear. Northern Ireland and protecting Ireland came out absolutely in front of any of those kind of economic events. So she was indeed a friend to us, and we should remember that.
Yeah. I suppose one of the things even to look at when you consider these in the context of the European picture as well, is Europe in a better condition than 16 years ago when Angela Merkel took over? And I think it's probably hard to argue it is.
Yeah, and like I was reading that, you know, the amount of crises that she's overseen, you know, the financial crash, the euro, then COVID, and now this climate crisis. She has, you know, been a steady hand on the tiller for quite a long time. So I think, and I think when we look at European leaders, whether it's Macron or Merkel or wherever, we don't pay that much attention. We see them when it comes to Brexit, they come over to Farmley House a couple of times during the year and we like, aren't they great? And we don't really study it any further than that. And I think, yeah, when you like look a bit further into it, we probably don't know that much about these people. But I do think Merkel has been, for all her flaws, a steady hand on the tiller when it comes to Europe. And I do think she will be missed. I would kind of worry now in this, even though there is, as you said, a lot more continuity, I would kind of worry now that without her, there will be a gap.
Was there an element of this kind of touched on in the papers, John, of a consensus builder to her that she, stuff like Keith has pointed out that we wouldn't see in day to day unless you're paying a lot of attention, that she actually did on the European stage to move things forward, even if it was that softly, softly you talked about?
Yeah, she was a consensus builder and it was easy to do business with Germany, I think, under her. But the flip side of this is that she really didn't have any strategic sense of what the European Union might be. And I think that means that the legacy for Olaf Scholz or whoever it's going to be and for European leaders in the European Council is actually a very difficult one. They kind of patched up the Eurozone, for example, with the fiscal treaty and the associated sort of elements of that back in 2012. But we may be headed for another global financial crisis. Look at the issues around the Evergrande property company in China, $300 billion in debt. China is a ticking time bomb, in my view. In respect of its model of financialization, it's not very different to the United States and very vulnerable. So how do we protect against those things? And she really did the minimum possible because she knew in Germany there was very little appetite for any kind of Eurozone model that might provide more sort of leverage to debtor countries in Southern Europe. Remember how opposed they were, so many German people, to the bailouts back then. So that's one critical area. The other was on defense policy, and that's become a much bigger issue with not just the relationship with Russia, but with China in recent weeks. It's Emmanuel Macron who has been pushing consistently for a much deeper European defense commitment, independent potentially of NATO. And if you look back, there's been no progress in that area at all over the last 20 years. We are no closer to a European army, even a very small European army, than we were when the Nice Treaty was being debated here in 01. So that lack of strategic vision, I think, might not be as apparent today in its significance, but it will matter in the years to come.
Aoife, when we're talking, and you mentioned obviously the climate change factor in this, which is huge for Germany as it is for every country. When we move into coalitions like this, and maybe it would be different if the Greens are coalition in Germany, but more general, take into account Ireland as well, you obviously need to build that consensus. And that does that not in itself lead to a slow pace of change, which is exactly what we're seeing here?
Yeah, and like when you read about the elections, they'll say, yeah, climate change is very front and centre, especially I think the floods really, you know, settled people's minds. And I remember at the time of the floods, I was watching the news and there was this German woman who'd like just lost her home or whatever and obviously very distressed. And she said things like, this don't happen in Germany, you expect it in other, and like the way she said it is like you expect it in kind of foreign countries. And I think that's the major issue with climate change is that everyone thinks it happens in places like Indonesia or places where there's earthquakes and all this sort of stuff. And they were saying that like the floods have now really settled people's minds and that climate change is going to be an issue for them. But when it comes down to the brass tacks of what you actually have to do to counteract the climate emergency, nobody wants to do it, whether it's like taxes or getting rid of things that we all love because they're bad for the environment. And we see that in Ireland too. You know, we've seen the rise about carbon taxes. We need to put money into public transport. So there's going to they're going to have all the same issues because that is what the problem is. Like everyone wants to tackle the climate emergency, but nobody wants to give up anything in order to do that. And I think that'll be the next crisis for them, is a finding a consensus that doesn't, it needs to be a just transition as well, so it doesn't, you know, target the most vulnerable people. But I think from what I've seen already, and when you look at the policies and stuff in Germany, is that it tends to be, it'll be the lowest income people that are going to be left behind when it comes to tackling the climate emergency. And like they can get all the consensus they want, but I think this will be a really difficult task for them coming on it.
On the record with Gavin Riley on News Talk.
You're very welcome back to News Talks on the Record. Sean Defoe in for Gavin Riley until 1 o'clock with you this weekend. Still going through the Sunday papers with John O'Drennan and Aoife Moore. We're picking back up on the discussion we were just having before the break about climate change and the electricity crisis. We'll get into the electricity crisis in a second, but just finally on the German elections, John. The last poll I saw had the Greens at 17%, so that it seems they are perhaps taking this a bit more seriously than we are in terms of a Green Party, because I think we finished on 7% for the Greens here at the last election.
Yeah, well, of course, the Greens have been around in Germany for a very long time and they've made incremental progress. But I'm kind of surprised that they went backwards during the campaign, because Aoife highlighted the floods, for example, and you'd have thought that they'd get a lot more traction because of that. But that doesn't seem to have happened, partly because there were a few missteps by its leader, Ms. Baerbock. But I still think it's very likely they will be part of a new coalition.
Okay. Page 3 of the Sunday Business Post has the, or just the Business Post now as it is, has the most worrying story, I have to say, I've read in the papers today. Daniel Murray has a snippet of the Air Grid report that is due to be released this week. And the nub of it, Aoife, is it won't be possible to secure enough new electricity generation in the years ahead to meet the rapid increase in power demand. take that where you will. That's rather worrying.
One crisis at a time, Sean. I find that incredibly worrying. When I read it today, it is absolutely stark. They said it was actually, the report had been, the publishing of the report had been delayed because of the seriousness of it. I don't know if they wanted to go back and check just to make sure they hadn't gotten anything wrong, because it was so stark and depressing. We were talking about this earlier. We might never be able to buy a house, and then if we buy a house, we might be able to turn the lights on. I think this is going to be the next crisis for the government. We are slow walking under it. They can see it coming. We have, I was just reading this today, that in terms of data centres, there's 70 data centres in Ireland, and another 30 have planning approval already. They're already talking about more. We know that data centres eat up so much water and electricity, no matter how much renewable energy they say that they use. They're using so much electricity. So they reckon by 2029, 27% of all Irish electricity will be used by data centres. Over half of our electricity will be used by data centres by 2030. At the minute, it's 11% of all the electricity in Ireland has been eaten up by data centres.
And the Social Democrats in the Dáil do have a bill this week coming up that will essentially looks to stop these. What their argument is, we need to do a cost benefit analysis, see is this worth it, and we should suspend any new data centres in the meantime.
Absolutely. So the government will argue that we need these data centres because these huge companies need them in order to stay in Ireland. But I would also argue that the people who work in those data centres need to be able to turn their lights on when they come home from work. So I think there needs to be some kind of analysis. We need to see if this is actually worth all the hassle that we're getting. We, you know, Eamon Ryan is saying that he doesn't think that we're going to see rolling blackouts this winter. I am very nervous. I do not think that there is enough contingency plan in place. They keep saying there's contingency plans in place. We haven't really seen the detail of them. I would like to see them ASAP. We're now nearly in October. We know with this winter, with climate change and everything else, it's going to be a lot harsher. And I really feel like we're slow walking into a crisis here when it comes to electricity and energy.
And John, that point of the data centres, I mean, it's a very tricky one, because a lot of the big companies we have here who do employ a lot of people say they need these data centres in order to do their job. But on the flip side then, you're totally putting the grid under strain.
That's right. When I was coming in, actually, I passed the Intel plant in Leixlip, and there's an 8 billion euro investment in that plant. So it's part of the problem that IFA points to, which is that by 2030, almost 30% of our electricity will be hoovered up by such data centres. And Intel, and this story is on the front of the Business Post, and actually it sums up very well the dilemma we face first about economic investment and bringing in FDI, foreign direct investment, versus climate change priorities. Intel was thought to be considering a plant in potentially in Oranmore, which the IEA, I think, had identified suitable for another much larger data centre than the one in Leixlip. But we're in competition there with Germany and Poland, and it looks like Germany, the reporting suggests, is ahead, partly because of the great fears now that multinational corporations here have about Ireland's reliability, about whether, as Aoife says, the lights will be maintained into the future. But that dilemma, I think, is a very real one. As we come out of COVID, we're trying to seed future investment, trying to maintain our position as a world leader in attracting FDI. And yet, the trade-offs here are enormous. Part of this, I think, is also about how we failed coming out of the last crisis in 2010 to really think about putting climate change front and centre of priorities, government priorities. We could have become what Denmark is, which is a world leader, for example, in wind energy. Now, that's kind of problematic given what's happened this summer, the drop in wind. Even in September, one of the newspapers today is saying that there are virtually no gales at all. It's been a very exceptional month. And so the amount of wind being captured in the system is much less than would normally be the case. And that was the case all the way through the summer. So we are, for two decades or more, as Colin McCarthy points out in The Independent, we're likely to be dependent on gas as a critical part of our supply. And God only knows how we're going to cope with even residential demands, the increase in residential demands, because we have a growing population. The demographic kind of situation manifests itself, extreme pressure on housing, and on other issues, but it's here as well. And I think Aoife's absolutely right. There's no confidence, not just in multinationals, but I think across the board in our ability over the next 10 years to both meet our climate change priorities, and the Taoiseach addressed that when he chaired the UN General Assembly this week, and at the same time maintain the advantages that we have had for a long time in attracting in foreign direct investment. Something's got to give.
Page 7 of the Business Post, Daniel Murray also writing that the government is set to revise its policy on data centres after negotiation and a push from the tech giants. John, are other European countries having these debates, or is it less of an issue for them because they've more of a proliferation of power, some including nuclear?
Yeah, but actually Germany, to go back to our early discussion, also has these kind of dilemmas. You remember after the terrible meltdown in Fukushima in Japan, that almost single-handedly put an end in Germany to any talk of investing in nuclear power.
Okay. Now,
France is the big nuclear power generator in Europe. I think 70 to 80% of its electricity actually comes from nuclear power.
Right.
But they are exceptions. Denmark is a world leader in wind energy. But I think there's an EU dimension to this as well. The EU, I think, has been very good at putting climate change at the core of its kind of policy mix. Ursula von der Leyen in the Commission, in particular, from day one, she's been very, very keen on doing that. The EU recovery funds are centred very much on climate change investments and on digitisation. But we haven't done enough. And the problem is, if we are to do enough, there is an economic cost to that that's going to be very, very difficult. And one of the risks in terms of impacting the more vulnerable communities that Aoife talked about, is that if you do move in the direction of imposing new sort of costly climate change measures, you're going to open the door potentially for many new populist parties to emerge, or the existing ones to actually increase their support significantly over the 10 years ahead. It's an incredible dilemma that most governments in Europe are facing.
Yeah, and of course, I mean, that is the bottom line of this really, Aoife, isn't it? That this winter is going to be more expensive. We've seen, I think, 31 increases from different energy providers throughout this year already. What are you hearing around Leinster House in terms of the budget, and is the government going to do anything to try and, you know, address that increase for people?
Yeah, well, Leo Varadkar's obviously gone through some kind of regeneration himself. He's now incredibly left-wing when it comes to social welfare. I've never seen him so generous. Yeah, we're seeing a lot of signals now about the budget. You know, most of us know what's on the budget about 4 weeks before the budget's actually published. At this stage, we get so many leaks. But, you know, there was a lot of talk, you know, even in leaders' questions during the week there. The Taoiseach did say, listen, when you go to the petrol station forecourt, when you go to the supermarket, when you're paying your energy bills, he knows people are recognising that the price of everything is going up, and we're going to have to, you know, match that with, there'll be more money for welfare. There was a lot of talk about the fuel allowance, you know, getting rid of the means test. They were talking about maximum price caps, although Varadkar did pour a wee bit of cold water on that in terms of, like, he talked about the issues that the UK had when they brought in the price caps. So it is definitely something that's on their mind. It's definitely on the cabinet table and the agenda, because they are worried about it. They know that. Like, they know that inflation is rising as well, and demand is obviously rising. So I think, yeah, we're not going to get the same budget that we got last year. Really, we're just throwing money at anything and everything. But I think they are already signaling there is going to be increases, because they know it's more expensive to live in Ireland this year.
But it does yet still seem, through all the leaks, to be a budget where everyone is getting something between pandemic bonuses, all these different things. Where's the money coming from?
Yeah, I should remember at the Fine Gael, I can't remember what it was, some kind of conference, when Leo Varadkar said, you know, he wanted millions and millions for healthcare. I'm sure Stephen Donnelly was delighted to hear that Varadkar was advocating for more money for the Department of Health. Yeah, I think there has been a lot of talk, and I really want it to be genuine. If it is, there's been a lot of talk of coming out of COVID and having something like, and having a bigger state, and maybe keeping all the good things from COVID, you know, a bigger state, more money for healthcare, more money for vulnerable communities, things like that. I think that would be great if it's genuine. Mm-hmm. It all comes down to what Pascal or Michael are willing to give you. And they'll all be in, you know, their crisis talks now in the next couple of weeks. But they have signaled already that it is going to be a bigger state. So it does seem like we are going to get a bit more money.
Mm. I know that's something Gavin talks about a lot, is that in the last budgets, that's two budgets, they have baked in a lot of recurrent spending. It's not stuff that you is the one-off that we borrowed for during COVID. This is stuff we're going to have to pay for out into the future. We're going to be talking to Minister Roger O'Gorman on the record here on News Talk after 12 o'clock, and he's got plenty in his department that he's seeking money for from the two finance ministers. But one of those that the two of them are going to be pushed on has been a big issue in the Dáil, Aoife, is the MICA redress scheme. And it looks as though it's going to go beyond the 90, but we don't quite know is it going to be 100%. Is that right?
Yeah, so the last I heard, and I was an Examiner on Saturday, that the officials in the Department of Housing have told the MICA Action Group that they will not be advising the government to give 100% redress to each family. We heard some talk during the week from different sources that it could be capped at $500,000 per home. There are some homes in Mayo and Donegal that are up to 800,000. They are not going to get 100% redress. I think you can safely say that now. The MICA Action Group have said they will leave no one behind. Well, they are not going to, the way it was put to me was, how are they going to decide, you know, if it's a pensioner on her own, they're going to tell her you're not getting 100%, or there could be, there's families there of children with additional needs, are you going to tell them that they're not getting 100%? And the thing I keep hearing, when you talk to the TDs, the government TDs especially, who are from, you know, the affected counties, Mayo and Donegal, they're saying, you know, keeping your seat is one thing, but they are more concerned that a house is going to fall down on top of somebody. And I have said this before on public broadcast, this country has a very bad habit of waiting for the worst possible thing to happen before they take any action. And I would be really concerned that that's what's going to happen here. These people's houses have been crumbling since the early 2000s. We're heading into a very cold winter, and this needs to be sorted ASAP. The government can find the money. We have done these things before. We have built dams. We can find the money when things happen. These people live in these houses through no fault of their own. It is not their fault. The building regulations were clearly not strong enough, and the buck stops with the government. And now the officials have said that they're not going to advise for 100%. This will be a government decision, and they know, and they have been told, that in those counties, you can forget about getting a TD, a Fianna Fáil or Fine Gael TD in those counties again, if it's not 100%. Councillors have basically said, we can't even go to the doors anymore if it's not going to be 100%, because there is so much public support. People really understand that these people haven't done anything wrong. And I think this might be the next minor, I know we have crises all the time, but the next minor crisis of the government, because they're going to, it's going to be a political decision rather than, you know, the officials advise this, that or the other. It'll be a political decision about what they're going to do.
But there will be people listening saying, and I've seen them on the text line before, fair enough for the vast majority of them, but if you have the money to build a house that's worth €1 million, why should the taxpayer foot your bill?
Yeah, and like, I can see where people are coming from, because it's also, you need to remember, a lot of these are like one-off houses. It's like, they're not, you know, in a terraced house in an estate. But the other issue is, this is through no fault of their own. The blocks are defective. They are in danger. I think that's the only thing we need to remember. And if the building regulations weren't strong enough to stop houses being built with defective blocks, well, then the buck stops with the government. I understand why people are annoyed. I understand why people don't think it should be 100%. But if it was your house and your family, what would you want?
On the record with Gavin Riley on News Talk.
You're very welcome back to On the Record. Sean Defoe filling in with Gavin Riley until 1 o'clock today. Now, look, lots in the papers on the fallout of Brexit and more reports of the prospect of the UK deciding to trigger Article 16 of the Northern Ireland Protocol and what the result of that would be. EU Commissioner for Financial Services, Mairead McGuinness, has been talking this morning to Andrew Marr on the BBC. Here's some of what she had to say.
What we're saying is the European Union finds solutions every day in our normal work. We can find solutions here. We want that the member states, the 27, hold together and provide solutions for Northern Ireland. And I think the one thing that's quite interesting is that the voice of Northern Ireland before the referendum, during the referendum and subsequently, in my view, has not been heard sufficiently, which was why the European Union listened carefully.
Commissioner, can I put it to you, looking at the actions of the British government, grace period after grace period after grace period, and then the talk about Article 16, they basically don't think there are any circumstances at all in which the EU side would put any kind of hard border across the island of Ireland, and therefore they can, as it were, carry on ignoring parts of the protocol. That's the truth, and what I want to hear is what your side is going to do about it.
I have to say, if that's the truth, it's a very irresponsible truth, frankly. We are all duty bound to find solutions to the problems facing people and communities in Northern Ireland in relation to Brexit. Because I think the one word we forget to say as the problem is Brexit. The protocol is the solution, and the difficulties in its implementation can be resolved. But they can't be resolved if the atmosphere is not friendly. So I think that obviously Brexit has fragmented relationships, but we are duty bound to get over that and to work together to find solutions. And indeed, the UK could come forward with proposals, for example, on animal and plant health. I know they've said they won't. We're not in the mood of saying, no, we're not doing anything. Mm. We've said the opposite. We're going to put forward concrete proposals, having listened to people in Northern Ireland. And I hope that the United Kingdom government and Lord Frost will believe with sincerity what we are saying. There are too many global challenges. I listened to your earlier items on energy, on skills shortages. We need to work together. We don't need to keep this divisive atmosphere, because Northern Ireland will suffer, and I think that would be reprehensible. So we are in solutions mode. We are talking directly, helping communities in Northern Ireland, and we will continue to do that.
Mairead McGuinness, the EU Commissioner for Financial Services, talking this morning to Andrew Marr on the BBC. I'm joined in studio as my newspaper panel, John O'Brien from Maynooth University and Aoife Moore from the Irish Examiner, and of course a Northern Ireland resident. So as the resident Northern Ireland person in the room.
The token.
Yeah, the
token Nordy.
Token Nordy, yeah.
Look, what do you make of that? Brexit is kind of heating up again across the papers, and sort of this cover that it had, if you want to put it that way, from COVID is pretty much gone.
Yeah, and I think Mairead McGuinness is 100% right there, and I felt this the whole way through Brexit, is that the whole way through Brexit and all these discussions, everybody is talking about the North and no one is talking to the North. What you'll often find, and we have found, that the Stormont parties, the majority of the Stormont parties, where Alliance, Greens, Sinn Féin, the SDLP, are united on the protocol. They think it's the best thing for Northern Ireland. We have seen already, you know, the shortages that that England is having, you know, with petrol and different food and, you know, their empty shelves. Northern Ireland is not having any of that because of the protocol. We are, you know, what's the word? We are saved from all that because of the protocol. The parties in Stormont are united on that, apart from the DUP and the TUV. I would also say that we need to keep in mind that the DUP are having a terrible time in the polls, and every time the DUP have a terrible time in the polls, they lead loyalist and unionist communities up to the top of the hill and leave them there. This is all political posturing, because the DUP know that they are hemorrhaging voters on one side to the TUV, who are a lot more right-wing, and then on the other side they are losing votes to the Alliance. Young people my age, who traditionally might have been, you know, Protestant unionist voters, are falling further and further away from the DUP. This identity politics that they have built their base around is not what people are interested in anymore. I think the EU especially must have the patience of a saint, because Britain is not a good negotiating partner. I think the more and more we go into Brexit, we find that they just want to have their cake and eat it. They thought Brexit was going to be this great white hope for them. It has turned out to be a disaster, but in our defence, we warned them it was going to be a disaster. I think threatening, you know, talk of a border in Northern Ireland and everything else is incredibly, incredibly dangerous. But I'm also not surprised. Boris Johnson knew very little about Northern Ireland when he became Prime Minister. I would argue he probably knows less since Brexit has started. I think, yeah, COVID kind of put it on the back burner for a good while. But I think what we need to keep in mind is that we need to talk to the people in the North, because we are the people who are going to be most affected by it. And most of the parties in Stormont are united that the protocol is the solution.
John, what stood out to you from the papers when it comes to Brexit?
Well, I could really sense the frustration, the utter frustration in Mairead McGuinness's voice there. Here we go again. How many times has she got to go on British television and explain what has happened? The British government committed 9 months ago to a legally solemn agreement. And as soon as they ratified it, remember the oven-ready deal? They rushed it through Westminster, huge support for it, and then they began to unpick it and began to threaten to resile from their commitments. They will not be allowed to do that. The European Union has been very firm about that. They can threaten as much as they want to, a bit like the grand old Duke of York, as Aoife said, you march the troops up to the top of the hill. It's not just the DUP, it's Johnson as well. But I think the reason that the rhetoric has actually increased in recent weeks is that increasingly the reality of what Brexit has done to Britain is becoming obvious. If you look at the energy issues, there are issues, the HGV drivers as well, all around Europe. But we are not seeing our supermarket shelves being emptied. We are not seeing huge queues at the petrol pumps as they are in Britain. Brexit has made everything infinitely worse because it's put up all these new barriers to trade in one direction at the moment, remember, because Britain hasn't yet imposed import controls on its side. And when it does that, the problem will be magnified again. Mairead McGuinness also pointed out that the European Union looked at the command paper and said, OK, we will give you a response to this. Maris Sefcovic, who's in charge of this on the EU side, is going to come out with some proposed solutions, but within the parameters set out by the agreement. It could mean, for example, that Northern Ireland political representatives could have a voice and a role at the table, which they haven't had thus far. I think that would be a very good idea because they can get to hear directly, as Sefcovic did a few weeks ago when he was in Belfast. But fundamentally, nothing is going to change. All of this is about the trade-off, the choice, the kind of Brexit that Frost and Johnson opted for. It's completely unmanageable from their point of view, and they have refused to be honest with the British people about the downsides of this. They blame COVID because it's convenient to do so. Some of their supporters have been all over the media this week blaming COVID for the shortage of HGV drivers, for example. They will not be able to go on doing that indefinitely. And it is disgraceful that they are using Northern Ireland in a context where they didn't even mention it in the course of the referendum campaign, or as Mairead said, subsequent to it, with all the inherent risks that come with doing that damage to a very fragile political ecosystem in Northern Ireland. The EU will go some way to meet their concerns, I think, in the weeks to come, but there will be no renegotiation of the protocol.
And plenty more look to talk on that in the coming days, no doubt. We've run out of time, unfortunately. One more story we wanted to get to briefly, I'll mention it in the Irish Daily Mail, live a story which we've talked about on this show before, this idea in Fine Gael that Leo Varadkar, Simon Coveney and Pascal Donoghue are all going to swan off to nice big jobs in Europe at some point, and they've actually done an odds-on who's the next to replace them. Odds-on favourite Simon Harris at 5-4, of course, who's just on parents' leave this week after the birth of his son, and a big congratulations to him and Kiva on that. Second favourite, Helen McEntee, 3-1. Heather Humphreys at 10-1, and then the dark horse, Jennifer Carroll McNeil, 66-1. So have a look at that if you are picking up the Daily Mail today. My thanks to our panel, John O'Brien, Professor of European Politics at NUI Maynooth, and Aoife Moore, Political Correspondent at the Irish Examiner. Thanks for joining us this morning.